Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather, now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group, no purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions, 18 plus.
The Stand, Episode 7, The Walk, is over, but we're just getting started here on post-show recaps, and what a long, strange trip it has been. And hopefully we'll get through the whole podcast with nobody pulling up in a limo to get us there the rest of the way fast. We're going to do this right on our own time frame. My name is Jessica Leese, and I'm here to guide you through everything that happens in this seventh hour of what feels like the 700th hour. And with me, as always, is a man who I found because there were a bunch of vultures over my head, and I think he's going to be fine, but we'll just have to see. I have Mr. Rob Sesternino. Hello, Rob.
Jess, yeah, I'm just finishing off this payday that is such a delicious snack as I've been impaled on my podcast microphone.
Yeah, it's rough, Rob. Did you finish that manifesto?
I'm still working on it. Please call me Hawk.
I will not. But we have a special treat for you guys this week. You may know him from Survivor Circles as the author of the really hilarious, funny 115. And he's also the host of the Staff Pick podcast. And also he has the distinction of being the person who is highest on this miniseries of anybody I know. Please welcome to the podcast, Mario Lanza.
Whoa.
Wow. Thank you. Wait, okay. Well, let me, before I'm going to dive right into this, you guys don't like this version of The Stand?
Well, we like some of it.
Yeah. I don't think we've hated it. I think that we were higher in the beginning, and I think that's sort of like the middle third. I think that we've been stuck a little bit here in the valley of the shadow of death in the middle, but I feel like that maybe we're coming out on the other side.
Okay, well, thank God I am here to provide some enthusiasm for the greatest version of The Stand we are ever going to get in our lifetime.
Wow.
Wow. That is right. High praise, sir. Well, before we get too far down this road, because now I am hella intrigued about this, but I want to take a moment to thank our sponsors. Those are our friends over at Geico. Do you own or rent your home? Sure you do. And I bet it can be hard work, but you know what's easy? Bundling policies with Geico. Geico makes it easy to bundle your homeowner's or renter's insurance along with your auto policy. And it's a good thing, too, because you already have so much to do around your home. Go to geico.com, get a quote, see how much you could save. It's Geico easy. Visit geico.com today. That's geico.com. And honestly, I heard they do motorcycle insurance, so I feel like Harold maybe should have checked that out.
Yeah, check that out.
Yep. For sure. So, Mario, one of the reasons I definitely wanted to have you on was because after the first episode, like my one exposure to any kind of opinions on The Stand came from Josh Wigler, who watched one episode and said, I am out on this. I do not want anything to do with it. And I hate it so much. I want it all to die. And then after the first episode dropped, here is Mario saying, this is the most glorious adaptation of The Stand I've ever seen. I'm really excited about it. I can't wait to see it. And I was like, what?
Out of the two adaptations, let me point out.
Out of the two adaptations, that is fair. But I was just floored by this, and you had some very good points. So I want to know, now that we're seven episodes in, has it been holding up for you?
First off, can I make a quick announcement? This is very important.
Yes.
My name is Mario J. Lanza. I do this podcast of my own free will.
Yes. Thank you.
Okay, good.
You. Good to know.
Yeah.
Now I'd like to accept the results of this podcast in toto.
Yes, thank you.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. First, a little background. The Stand is my all-time favorite book. It's the book that changed my life the most. I try to reread it every couple of years, although it's been a while. I know it pretty well. Like, I just love everything about this book. Although there are some flaws in this book, I will be the first to admit. Mm-hmm. Stephen King has never thought it's his best book. He's, in fact, a little hurt that people always say this is his best book, because it'll be like, so I've never written anything good since 1978. That's what he'll often say that. But like, I love this book so much. I give it to everybody I know. My wife, I introduced to it. I had a girlfriend in high school. I let borrow it. And I still to this day remember fond memories of her coming into school the day after Nick died. Nick blows up in the explosion.
Oh, yes.
And she threw the book at me. She was so upset that that scene happened. And wow. So I always consider that my moment when I give this book to people. I want to know when they get to that Nick scene because it will piss everybody off. And let's see what else. I do one of the things I do in my spare time is I'm a prison pen pal. I correspond with a lot of prisoners. I kind of help them with their education and stuff. Always, always, always send them The Stand. Just because if there's anything you have in prison, it's spare time and it's 1,300 pages.
Yeah.
So I always get. So again, I know.
Wait,
this
that
book.
Doesn't freak them out about the whole thing with Lloyd?
Oh yeah.
No, I mean they have bigger problems. Yeah. They have bigger fish to fry.
Okay.
That's a good point.
It's a small scene. That they're just happy to have something to do. So, yeah, so I have a long storied history with this book. I was really anticipating this movie. I guess we'll call it a movie. It's not really a movie, but it's not a miniseries yeah. either. But the reason why is because I do not love that 1994 version the way that most people do. I've always thought that was, well, it was good enough for what we had at the time, but someday they'll do it better. So this is my stance. I've never thought that was like a masterpiece like most people do.
Yeah, and I think we came into this podcast with a really sentimental attachment to that. Like, I don't make any claims that that is a good piece of media, especially 25 years after it dropped. But there is, I think we both have a lot of affection yeah. for it. In, yeah. And I do agree there are a lot of things they could have certainly done differently. But okay, so there's your background. So mm-hmm. how's it holding up past episode 7?
I love it. I've had no complaints with this after about the third episode. The one part I was kind of iffy on was Larry escaping from New York mm-hmm. because I was really pissed that they cut out the whole subway tunnel scene, the Holland Tunnel.
Someone who's not a New Yorker.
Yeah. But again, that's the centerpiece of, like, for years, I've been involved in Stephen King, you know, online fandoms, mm-hmm. fan groups since 1985 on, like, Prodigy and stuff. So, like, I know that's a beloved scene. Everyone always considers that's the standout scene in The Stand. That's the Holland Tunnel escape scene. Even Stephen King has said that was actually a pretty good scene. He likes that scene in the book. So I was mad that was cut. But other than that, I think it's been almost flawless for what they're trying to do, to be honest.
Oh, that's hilarious, Mario, because that's my favorite thing that they've fixed.
That's fine. I mean,
yeah. It's like the one good thing I can say about it. And it's mostly a logistics thing. And I've always felt that way about it. Like since I've moved to New York, yeah. I've thought, well, I like the ambiance of it. I like the idea of it. And I know it's a beloved scene, mm-hmm. but it's like, it doesn't make any sense as a conceptual piece. Yeah. So I like that they tried to give you that same thing. I don't think they totally succeeded in getting the mood right, but at least they fixed the logistics.
Okay, that's fine. Yeah. At least you got further along than Wiggler did, so I'll give you that. Mm-hmm.
Mario, can I ask you about, since you're so involved with the Stephen King fandom, do you know, mm-hmm. has Stephen King said anything about this current adaptation?
He is very good. He didn't do this when he was younger. When he was younger, he would say how crappy his adaptations of his stuff was. He does not do that anymore. He's gotten more diplomatic as he's gotten older. So I have only heard smaller things from him, but they're all positive. He will not badmouth things as they're airing.
Yeah.
I think he especially wouldn't badmouth this episode, especially not the writing in it, because the writing credit for this episode goes to Owen King.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, his kid is all over this one. So, of course, he's going to love this one.
Mm-hmm.
And I know for a fact that Stephen King, this isn't going to spoil anything, he changed the ending of this one personally. He kind of helped write it. So, he has a lot at stake in this one.
Yeah.
We've been talking a lot about what we think is going to happen in that end. And I want to throw out a warning here. Skip ahead a couple of minutes if you're listening and you don't want the entire thing spoiled for you. But I think everybody knows by now that the nonlinear nature of the way that this story is being told means we've spoiled a lot so far.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to get into that because I would love to know your thoughts on what's going to happen and what is different about this ending, Mario.
Well, first off, you notice it hasn't been nonlinear since about the fourth or fifth episode. They've changed that.
Yeah. And can I also add that I feel like that the point in which that Jess and I have felt like the show has struggled has actually been since they've walked away mm-hmm. from that nonlinear structure. I feel like that they've spent too much time on this middle third of the story in Boulder.
See, I disagree. I will tell you because I think that is fixed a structural problem the book always had. And this is hard to say because, again, The Stand is my favorite book, is that the book is structured incorrectly. And I think this is what a lot of people are having problems with in the miniseries. The point of The Stand is not the plague. It's not the getting to Boulder and Las Vegas. The whole point of the book is, indeed, the title, The Stand.
Oh, I think you say the friends we made along the way.
The friends we made along the way. Yeah, all that. Laws, yes. But the whole point of the story is once it gets to Boulder and Las Vegas. Everything that happens up to Boulder and Las Vegas is really irrelevant, or not irrelevant, it's smaller. It's just setting up the story. And a lot of people get attached to the first part of the story because they love it so much, but that's, I think Stephen King would admit, that's not the interesting part of the story. He always wanted the second part to be the centerpiece, the main action, and I think that's what this miniseries is trying to do. And I know I'm completely ignoring your question on what the ending's going to be, but that's one argument I wanted to bring up.
We'll get to it, but if that's really the argument that Stephen King would make, why did he add 600 additional pages of that road trip onto the front of the book when he republished it?
You know why? Because fans were demanding that he republish the book, because there were these rumors for years. There's a longer version of The Stand, and I don't know if he necessarily would have put it out because he doesn't love this book. I think there was just all this pressure on him for years because people knew there was another version. And eventually he's like, you know, F it. I'll just bring it out here. Take it. But I don't think he's ever been especially proud of it, to be honest.
Yeah. And I mean, you have a point that it would not be called The Stand if The Stand was not the most important event. But mm-hmm. I think there's a lot of, I feel like it's one of his strongest books as far as creating characters that felt real to me.
Oh, yeah.
And I think the problem that this miniseries has had is that it skipped over a lot of that. Like the characters didn't feel developed and the relationships didn't feel developed because they glossed over so much of that road trip element. And I don't know what the answer is to that, but I certainly didn't feel like these characters are jumping off the screen for me the way that they jumped off the page in the book.
Yeah. And I'd agree with that. I 100% agree with you. And I struggled with that at first too. I don't know if most people listening to this won't know, but after every episode, I do this big, long thread of all my comments, and I have other people piping in. And a lot of times people can change my mind. And this is one I agreed with you on my assessment at first. I'm like, I like what they're doing with this, but I feel like we're missing a lot of the character development. And someone pointed out to me, a guy named Brian Brown, said, well, it's because that's not the market for this version of The Stand. The market for this is people who already know this story inside and out. This is like for experts only. And once that clicked in, I realized, oh, well, that makes more sense because they don't even bother with the character development because they assume you already know all this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Which I will flat out admit is probably the reason you, Rob, Wiggler, everyone was balking at it at first, because I think a lot of people were. But I see why the producers did that. They have a time constraint. They want to focus on the second half of this, not the first half. So unfortunately, that's what has to go. Unfortunately. I mean, what can you do about it?
I want to talk about that time constraint, actually, because we are now past hour 7 of this series. The runtime of the 1994 miniseries was 6 hours. How is it that they managed to pack that character development into the miniseries and we are still on hour 7, and what did they put in there for 7 hours instead of the characters meeting each other and forging bonds?
Yeah.
I don't understand.
The scenes in this version are longer. I've noticed that. When they have, like, Larry and Rita in the sewers, that goes on forever. Like, Harold meeting with Wezak goes on. They just like these long, drawn-out scenes. So that's where that time is going. Although, I would flip that question right around on you and say, where was the character development in the 94 miniseries? Have you watched it recently? There isn't that much in there, really.
I rewatched it recently, yeah. It doesn't hold up as well as we remember it. But I do think that they spent, like, the first 2 nights, basically, before they get to Boulder. I think that really, like, the third night takes place in Boulder, and I think they spend more time here. I think it's basically been, like, you know, 3-plus episodes of, like, life in Boulder for this version of it.
Yeah. In my opinion, again, I could be wrong. I'd listen to arguments against this. The only thing that was really lost in the character development scenes was the relationship between Nick and Tom. Mm-hmm. In this version. I really missed that. And, like, again, it's a producer choice. There's certain things that are going to be cut so they can include more stuff. Like, they include more Julie Lowry in this one. They include more stuff like that. They've cut Trash Can Man, but they cut Nick and Tom, which I have a problem with that because I love Nick and Tom. But I mean, the argument is that's not that significant a storyline, so you can see why that goes. Again, it's just what they have to choose to keep in and remove.
Yeah, it's fair, but I think that also kind of cuts off. And again, you make the point that if this is for people that already know the story, then they know that this is not, that this is sort of a false path that you're going down. But I remember my opinion of, you know, the first couple of episodes is, well, they got Rob Lowe to play this character and they're spending so much time on his journey and this bond that he makes with Tom. And he's such a central character. He has a deep relationship with Mother Abigail. He is going to be the most important guy. He's got to be the one that makes the stand. And I was reading the book kind of concurrently with watching the miniseries for the first time when I was like 14. And then Nick blows up and it's like, oh, he's not the guy. And it was just crushing in that way. And there's no inclination on the part of this series that Nick is at all important. He might as well not even be there, except that, you know, stuff blowing up, like they could blow up a house and that could be your impetus for taking your stand, I guess. He's basically, he's furniture. And I feel like that's, I agree with you. It's the thing that you lose the most of because it ends up not being, it's a catalyst, but it's not a catalyst in the same way here.
Yeah, they really did Nick dirty. And again, Nick, my favorite character in the book. I love that scene again, my high school girlfriend moment, getting the book thrown at me, which should horrify me. But no, I was so impressed that Stephen King could piss her off that much. So yeah, they really did Nick dirty in this miniseries. I feel bad, but I feel it's outweighed by other stuff they've added that is good. So it's, again, I can chalk that up to just a producer choice.
Yeah, like the only thing that nobody's even grieving Nick at this point. Like, I think the most we have gotten of grieving Nick is Larry asking out of nowhere, so is there anything left of him to bury?
Yeah,
it's dark.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Larry's
sentimental.
Nick is just a pirate. He was a wandering pirate in this one, and that was it. And he blew up. He was like Rupert.
Yeah. He's definitely the Rupert. A little bit quieter than Rupert, of course.
Yeah, but again, I would argue it sucks that we have less Nick, but there is so much more Harold in this miniseries.
Yes.
And because, this is why I was so high on that first episode. If you go back and look at my notes on Facebook, it was exactly, oh my God, they finally realized that Harold is the central character in most of this narrative. And that's missing in the 94 miniseries, where I've always argued the biggest butchery they did in 94 was they screwed up Harold and Franny, who were the absolute worst casting choices. And they're like the centerpiece of part of the book.
You don't like Parker Lewis?
No, I do not like Corin Nemec. He was terrible. Parker Lewis lost in that one. He was horrible.
Well, can you talk this through, Mario? Because we've talked about the decision to go with so heavy on Harold.
Okay. This is something I've been writing on message boards since 1986. So this is a well-prepared stump speech here. Is that Harold Lauder is the most interesting one in the stand because he really has the most complex growth arc, where he's sympathetic at first, then he's a noble failure. He's trying his best, but he's not good at what he's doing. He's trying to lead Franny. He's much more sympathetic in the book than we saw in this. They shortened him. They truncated him a little bit. Then he gets cock-blocked by Stu. He turns bitter and evil, turns into an incel, and he's horrible. He's like the biggest villain in the book. And then he kind of sees the error of his ways because he's used. And it's like you kind of feel bad for him when he dies. He's got the most complex story arc. It's really him and Larry, the only two that really have complex arcs in the book. And so I was so pissed off in 94 that they didn't understand that character. That's the one thing, is that if people haven't read the book, he's this fat loser. He's just gross, and everyone's grossed out by him. And then it's not so much that Franny, you know, is repulsed by him. She just feels bad for him. He's kind of this sad loser. And then he shapes up. He becomes more good looking. He learns capable skills. He becomes better, but just no one's interested, and he's very bitter. And they got rid of all that weight loss and him being gross in the 94 miniseries. All they did was they took Parker Lewis and they gave him a couple pimples, if you remember.
Mm-hmm. Yep, I remember.
Yeah. So they just ruined it. I'm like, he is so interesting. And I remember having debates with my girlfriend in high school about this too. I'm like, Harold's the most interesting character in the book. And she's like, oh, he's so gross. And like, no, you just don't, you're not thinking of it from a bigger level, what he adds to the story, both good and bad. He ping pongs all over the place. So they really tried in the first episode of this one to focus it on Harold right from the start. Like, they're making a statement. The first 20 minutes of episode one are about Harold Lauder. And that was why I liked episode one and more than most people did. I'm like, they finally, even if they missed some of the details, they got the point of Harold right. And that was a big thing for me.
I don't know that they did, Mario. I agree with you that they get him a little bit better than the 94 miniseries did.
Yeah.
But I feel like you come away from this feeling like, wow, you know, if only Franny had put her hand on this guy's junk, maybe none of this would have happened. And I don't think that's the point of Harold either. No. Never got the sense that he's struggling. He never seems to struggle against this idea that he's improving and he could be a part of the community in a real way. He never is real with that.
Yeah.
He's never tempted to just like be Hawk and settle in. And I feel like that's kind of the main thrust of him, is that he needs to, you know, he sees his place in Boulder, but it's not quite the place he wants. So he is tempted to the dark side. And here it was just like, oh, well, this woman wouldn't touch his junk, but this woman would. And so he's going to go with this woman. And boy, you know, it should have really gone the other way.
No, I agree with you on a more conceptual level. I'm just saying they're much closer. This is so much closer to what the book is supposed to be with Harold that the miniseries doesn't even try. So that's my argument. I agree with you. They don't quite get Harold all the way.
That's fair.
Yeah.
Although we get a lot more Harold. This is like the most Harold-y episode since the first one.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and it's good because I think he's the most fascinating actor out of the bunch in the show. So I like more Harold. Again, he's a gross character, but I do like the guy portraying him.
Can we talk about what happens to Harold here in this episode? And because that, I think that there is, I think a major change from the 94 version. And I don't remember exactly how it happens in the book, but in this adaptation, in the 2020 version, that Nadine basically kills Harold here,
yes.
Where in the 1994 version that we end up seeing where Flag like pops up out of nowhere, causes him to skid out, and it's Flag that takes out Harold. And I thought this was very interesting to have Nadine have this blood on her hands.
Well, okay, I know Jessica probably has something to comment on this, but I just want to say this first. This movie, I have noticed, has been a lot more proactive about giving the female characters more to do.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a gripe that has been, you know, driven towards Stephen King since the beginning of his writing days, that he does not write female characters well, and they're often just, you know, secondary characters to the men. And I've noticed in this one, they've really tried to give the females more to do. Franny's had a lot more to do in this one, like going to Harold's house, being proactive, looking. That's not in the book, if I recall. And Nadine is a lot more proactive in her fate, to the point that she kills Harold in this one. So, but I think that's a very cognitive effort on the producers. They're trying to fix one of the things Stephen King has always had, is that there aren't that many females in the stand that actually do much.
Yeah, I would definitely agree with that. And I liked their attempt to give her a motive to do that. And it's not just like he's in the way of me being with Flag, because he's really not. Like, Flag is not going to let anything be in the way of what he wants. But you have this horrible conversation that they have where Harold's like, yeah, we can't touch each other anymore, which I think is something Nadine says in the book. And he's like, yeah, you belong to Flag, and Flag is going to give me a girl way hotter than you. And it was like, okay.
Well, I believe his quote was, he's going to give me a woman that makes you look like a potato sack. And it always bothered me, especially in the 1994 version. I feel like it's even worse. Like, maybe he doesn't say anything that's that harsh, but for whatever reason, Harold just starts being horrible to Nadine for no reason. And I never got that.
Yeah, she's been very good to him.
Yeah.
Yeah. I would say so. Yeah, she's been.
Like, why are you being rude to her all of a sudden?
Can we also point out that if there were such a woman who is that much hotter than Nadine, why isn't Flag going to be with that girl?
Yeah. Also, like, should you be insulting the boss's main squeeze like this?
Yeah. I've seen gangster movies. That never ends well. Do not insult the boss. Isn't that how Pulp Fiction? That's almost happened to Vincent Vega.
Yeah. It's It's really a bad call on Harold's part. And he's so entitled. Like, I see why she wants to off him at that point. Mm-hmm. And I wondered in that moment, like, and again, because I think part of this is the problem of casting here, because I don't think Amber Heard is terribly well cast in this role, as Rob and I have discussed at length. But I see that they're planting the seeds for that motive to be there. Like, he's just a dick and she needs to get rid of him. But is she doing that because at Flag's behest, or is she doing it because she's mad at him? I didn't quite catch which one that's really supposed to be.
Yeah, I would suspect it's at her behest, that this whole story is grown-ups running circles around Harold Lauder because he's not on their level. And he thinks he has more power. And I think it's just at her behest. It's really just, I'm really tired of this guy. See ya. I don't think it's anymore. I mean, but the way they filmed it, it's up to interpretation. But that's how I interpret it.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that's how I would feel about it if I were Nadine.
Mm-hmm. Although, can we point out again how I just love to crap on the 94 miniseries? For people who haven't seen it in a while, the Harold death scene is so ridiculous. Because in the 94 miniseries, part 2, I believe, ends, or is it 3? Part 3 ends with Nick blowing up, and it's like a huge dramatic moment.
Yep.
And it's like, Harold and Nadine are now going to flee to Las Vegas now, you know, outcast from justice. And like, in the first 30 seconds of the next part, they're riding on their motorcycles and Harold's dead, and that's it. Mm-hmm. So much for that payoff.
Yeah, there's really not much there. And, you know, is there any working actress now today or in 1994 who could really do justice to Nadine? Because I feel like this is the most egregious miscasting on both of their parts.
Well, see, this is a sore subject because I loved Laura San Giacomo in the first one, even though many, many people have pointed out she's nothing like Nadine. She's way too over the top and crazy. But I don't care because she has crazy eyes and I love Laura San Giacomo.
And crazy eyebrows.
Nobody could top her for me, even though admittedly she's not really like the book.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know who could play Nadine. Nadine's a tough role.
Yeah, and it's hard because we've kind of, she definitely doesn't exude like nice teacher lady vibes.
No.
I don't think I had too big of a problem with Nadine in this adaptation in terms of Amber Heard's portrayal. I did think the ending of this episode was wild with Nadine, if we want to talk about that.
Wait, the one day pregnancy, you had a problem with that?
Well, the whole thing was just so wild, where it was sort of like that she has this encounter with Flag, which is like the, you know, Rey Kylo Ren romance. Like, they're not even in the same place. He somehow like impregnates her. And then the next day, then he comes and picks her up and she's gotten like a whole glow up since then.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and then she gets a wardrobe.
Are you a Flag denier, Rob?
I don't know.
Is it a false Flag operation?
I don't know. Well, like, if he could come out there with the car, why doesn't he just come out there and meet her?
I don't know. Yeah, that whole scene was weird. I wasn't expecting quite that level of graphic sex in The Stand, but okay. That was
a lot of Sarsgaard butt.
Yeah,
he Tommy Wiseau'd.
Yeah.
Yeah, but you know, they're on streaming, Mario. They can say the F word and they can show a lot of butt.
Okay, good. Good to know. I was not aware of that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Not prepared for the graphic sex scene between Amber Heard and the demon.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It was Rosemary's Baby levels. Like, you know that when Stephen King envisioned this scene, because it is very similar to what we get in the consummation scene in the book, you know he's thinking about that scene in Rosemary's Baby.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Let's see. Yeah. So what he knocks her up. She's pregnant within one day. She's got like a full term moving fetus in her mm-hmm. and she's got white hair. And like, yeah, that ending was so over the top, which I appreciate. I like when the show goes over the top because The Stand is a goofy movie or story.
Yeah.
But I like the ending. I thought it was fun.
The pulsating, baby bump.
Hey, they really do that, Rob.
I've seen it a little bit. I don't know about on that level.
Yeah, sometimes you see like a whole little foot.
I mean, yeah, that was like about to be like a scene from Alien where the thing is just going to pop out and greet Larry Underwood himself.
Yeah,
I mean, hello, my baby.
Yeah. Baby, you dig your baby?
Did you notice you heard the song finally, that little detail?
For the first time.
Yeah, I love that.
Yeah, they're playing his song.
It's, they sure teased us.
There's a lot of little in-jokes in this. They teased us with it the first time back in New York with Larry. He was going to play it, and then he stops. So we never heard it until now.
Mm-hmm. We heard like 10 seconds of it, and then we get like almost the whole thing, which it really does not sound like a song that would be climbing the charts in 2020.
No. Yeah.
There's not enough auto-tune.
It didn't sound like one that would climb the charts in 94. That's what I love. Like, who says, baby, can you dig your man in 94, let alone 2020? Mm-hmm.
Well, this is a problem with both adaptations, Mario, and I'd love to get your take on it. They have taken a lot of dialogues directly from this book that was written in 1978, mm-hmm. and a very Stephen King-y dialogue, like especially the way that Harold talks is the way that I don't think anybody talked in 1978, let alone now. And I wonder what your take on this is. Do you like that, or do you find it a little jarring?
I think it would be more jarring if they didn't change it, just because people know this book so well. So I think that's the trap they fall into.
Yeah.
If you start changing the dialogue, people are going to squawk. And people are already squawking because they've made a lot of changes as it is. But if you start verbatim changing huge speeches, I think people would really be upset.
Yeah.
That's my argument.
Could you make this a period piece?
Like what, in Elizabethan England?
No. I mean, set it in 1980 like it was originally intended.
Yeah, you could have. I mean, I don't see any reason why you wouldn't do that. Maybe they thought it'd feel like they were ripping off Stranger Things or something, but you could easily do that. They just chose not to.
Mm-hmm. That'd be interesting.
Yeah. And there's a few things that I liked some of the additions of 2020. Like, I like that we are on the Las Vegas Strip, which wasn't a thing in 1980.
Mm-hmm.
And the way that they've presented Las Vegas makes it seem simultaneously the best place and the worst place you've ever been, which that is Vegas.
Yeah, well, this is interesting because I had mentioned in my notes, I'm like, I love this version of Vegas. I could totally see why people would go there. And I made the comment, it's exactly like the Vegas in the book, which I guess I don't remember that because a couple people pointed out, no, the Vegas in the book is like hardworking and efficient and disciplined. And like you get hung on a cross if you break the rules or if there's hedonism. So I guess I kind of forgot that in the book, it's a little more structured. It's a little more, I guess, not unintentionally, a little more Nazi Germany, I think.
Yeah, I was going to say it's a little more fascist.
Yeah. So I guess I forgot that from the book.
Hard work is rewarded. And here it's just like, well, you can work. We'll give you a job if you want one, and you can be like the job you had before, or you can just go like put on some Mad Max bondage gear and gyrate on the casino floor. We're good with that too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's fun. Good times.
Yeah.
It is Vegas, like you said.
It is. I don't know where he's getting all these people
capital.
To run things. Yeah.
They have a lot of Tom Collins doing all the grunt work so all the other people can do fun stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I guess. I don't know, man. That is not a great look. Like, that's not, if I'm going to Vegas, I want to party in Vegas. I don't want to shovel body parts.
Mm-hmm.
Are you saying you have flaws with Flag's logic? How dare you, Jessica?
I know. I think maybe the people that he crucifies in Vegas are people that have problems with his logic.
Or the fun police.
Yeah.
But that is definitely getting back to the changes to the story that I think have been good in this version. I really think they've gone above and beyond in trying to make Vegas fun and making it a character, because that's something that I think was lacking in the book and the 94 miniseries, that the Vegas part of the story kind of gets short shrift compared to Boulder. And I think they're trying to fix that in this one, giving Vegas just as much airtime.
Yeah, well, I think it's very highly likely that two things were true when the book was written. I would say that Vegas was not as much a hedonistic pleasure center as it is now. Like, that really kind of happened in the 80s when the strip started to get built up. It was kind of like a place where you'd go to gamble and that was about it. But now it's Vegas, capital V.
Sin City.
Yeah. I think the other thing that was true is I would not imagine that Stephen King, a moderately successful novelist and father of three, writing this in 1978, I would bet money that, and you know, these would not be Vegas odds that he had never been to Vegas.
Oh yeah. Yeah. My family went there all the time. We didn't live that far from it. So we'd go there. It was a family trip. My parents, when we were kids, would say, "Here, Mario, here's $20, play video games, wander the strip. We'll see you at bedtime." And I'd be on the strip by myself at 10 the entire day.
Dang. Yeah.
Not how it works now.
Yeah. And the Lord of Darkness didn't talk to you on the Jumbotron.
He tried, but I went for Mother Abigail. I was more of a good guy, Rob.
Mother Abigail is in the arcade, clearly.
Yeah, Mm-hmm. Yeah, she was down there. Well, so was Flag, but for different reasons. But they were both there.
Yeah.
Yep. Well, now I'm really, excited to talk about Mother Abigail. But before we do that, I want to take a little moment and hear from our sponsors.
I put a spell on you. Because you're mine.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
And we're back. So, Mother Abigail. R.I.P. Mother Abigail?
Yeah, who cares?
Yeah, that's the thing. I kind of don't.
I kind of don't.
And Mario, what is your take on Whoopi as Mother Abigail?
I have never cared about Mother Abigail in any version of the story whatsoever. In fact, that's the only part of the book where I would routinely fast forward like 20 pages because I don't care about her making her effing bread. Like, and so I'm so happy they have negated her in the story because she's not interesting. Stephen King, you know, turned her into a cartoon character. Oh, I can see God. Oh, I will tell you, like I don't like her in the story. I never have. Whoopi does the best she can with this crappy material, but I am never going to like Mother Abigail. And I'm going to drop my mic here by saying I could not be happier that they change Hemingford Home into a nursing home, that she's just a crazy old woman. She doesn't have like a farm this time.
I
screw
like
you,
it.
Mother Abigail.
Wow. That's...
You sure you weren't off watching The Lord of Darkness on the Jumbotron, Mario?
Okay, I was in Vegas for part of the time with Flag. I mean, I had a couple of the death fights, but that was it.
Just a couple. Man, tell us how you really feel, dude.
Well, okay. Someone explain to me how Mother Abigail in the book is in any way interesting, please.
It's a good point. I mean, she's a connector, and I think the fact that they kill her before the ultimate stand underlines how not important she is. And I would say they do this three times, three being a magic religion number, I guess. They do this three times over the course of the story where you think the person who's going to be the most important aspect of the face-off between good and evil, you think that's your person, and then it ends up not being your person. I think Nick is the first instance of that. Mother Abigail is the second instance of that. And then Stu, who you think is the leader of the group, does not end up making it to the final confrontation.
Yeah, you had no idea Ralph Brentner would be the one to make it to the end against Flag.
Yeah, well...
No, that's Ray now.
Yeah,
we'll talk about Ray. That, yeah.
It is a shame about Ray, to quote a favorite band from the 90s, but I got to talk about Ray because I do feel like the few minutes we see of Ray this episode, it's like, why weren't we following her? She seems way more interesting than the rest of these Yahoos.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that was my big complaint. I haven't had too many complaints in my Facebook notes, but that has been one. I'm like, who is going to be the fourth member of the stand? Because we have not met Ralph Brentner, who people know in the book. He's the fourth guy. He's this hillbilly guy that kind of goes with them. And he had not shown up in the story. And I'm like, are they just going to send three? Is Nick going to go? Are they going to send Joe, the little kid? Who's going to be the fourth?
Mm-hmm.
And then someone pointed out, Ralph Brentner is Ray Brentner, Mario. You just haven't noticed it yet. And I'm like, if that's Ray Brentner, how come we've had no backstory on her whatsoever? And voila, they were right. That indeed is Ray Brentner. I had no idea. Like, all of a sudden, she's important, and we never heard from her for, like, six episodes.
She knows what water to drink.
Yes.
They have
Although,
her
again,
along.
Again, they are trying to make more prominent female characters and so on. So I appreciate that, but I really wish she would have been given as much backstory as Larry, Stu, and who's the other one?
Greg Kinnear. Yeah. Yeah, I definitely feel that like they're going to gender flip the character and just make her less important than a character who was already not important. And when I first saw this casting choice, I thought that's going to be so much fun. And then it's like she's even more of a nothing burger than miniseries Ralph, who was already a nothing burger. And it was just really disappointing. And so seeing her a little bit more of her this episode is great. I just wish we'd had her all along.
Yeah, I think she's great. She's so much better than Ralph. It's just, where was her backstory? I would have loved to see her backstory.
Well, I think here's the problem, Mario, and it goes back to your other chief complaint about this miniseries, is that in the original book, Ralph's main function is to sort of serve as that final connecting piece between Nick and Tom. So if you excise the Nick-Tom relationship from the story, you take out Ralph's main function. And here it was just like she's kind of Mother Abigail's other secretary other than Nick. That was like the one time you see her. And there's no like, it's almost they're like a power trio. And he's like the least important. He's like the Ginger Baker of the group. But you got your Nick and Tom, and they don't even know like each other's names until Ralph is there to translate. Mm-hmm. And then it's like the three of them hang out a lot together when they're not at the Free Zone committee meetings.
That's a good point.
Yeah, I really feel like if we'd had that relationship, if they'd found a way to weave that through, we would have known what she's like.
Yeah, I do like that we learned in this episode she's suddenly Native American.
Yeah.
That was like a big plot point I'd never heard until this episode.
I knew she was because she used a piece of Lakota slang in the last episode.
Oh.
Like she calls somebody like the Lakota word for like white a-hole.
Oh, white devil. Yeah.
How did you know that? Devil.
Because she used the word and then I looked it up. I just Googled the word.
Yes.
And Googling. I this is not a show where I typically have Google up all the time. Mm-hmm. It's not like The Crown, but occasionally you got to go to Google.
Well, see, this is the type of show that's going to reward you for multiple viewings already.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't think I'm going to get that far, Mario. But you go ahead.
I don't know. I honestly don't get why people don't like this version. This is so much better than the 94 version. Again, it's not perfect, but yeah. I also think this book is unfilmable. It's never going to be a satisfactory book. So you pick and choose which stuff you want to see. I think the stuff they've chosen for this one is far better than the stuff they chose in the first time. Maybe they'll do a better version the third time. I don't know. But I think this is the best we're ever going to get.
Mario, have you been keeping up with anybody who had not read the book who's watching this series?
No, because they would have shot themselves in the head after the second episode.
Yeah.
So
I didn't want to get attached to them.
I got to check back in with David Bloomberg.
Yeah, but again, that goes back to the main argument. This movie was not for them. Now, you can make the argument, is that ethical to make something like that is not accessible to everybody in the fandom? I think it's perfectly fine, but that's not the general sentiment. Like, I love that there's an advanced version of The Stand for people who know it inside and out that is absolutely not accessible to people who don't know the book. My argument is, well, go read the book and then you'll get more out of it. But that's not the general sentiment, I know.
Mm-hmm. I feel like TV shows shouldn't come with homework.
Yeah, but that's an argument. It's a good argument. I can't disagree with that. That's not how I look at it.
And I also feel like if we're going to make it just for people that read the book, let's steer fully into that skid and just like tell stories that haven't been adapted before, or even stories that weren't even in the book, like play around in that universe. It's kind of the same way, like I think the best adaptations of books for television are the ones that go way off the rails really early on. I would say I'd point to seasons 2 through 4 of Dexter. I'd point to The Magicians. They are still of that universe. They're playing by some of the rules, but they're having adventures that are not directly from the books. And I think if we're going to do an adaptation of The Stand that's just for people that read the books, let's play around in that universe. Let's see other things that are happening.
Yeah. And I'd agree they're doing some of that. There's some things they've veered off way off the book in this one. And I like most of the choices they've made. But getting back to the point, yeah, I agree with that. You shouldn't have to do homework for a TV series. But this is a unique book in that this is, like, without question, Stephen King's most famous and popular book and beloved book. So, like, there are so many millions of people that know this book inside and out that I don't have a problem with them doing that for this specific book.
Yeah, that's fair. Well, actually, now I want to ask you what you think of the biggest veering away from the book that I have personally witnessed in this series is Trash Can Man. What are your thoughts on Trash Can Man, Mario?
Well, he's like Mother Abigail in that there's way too much of him in the book, and most of it's tedious. It's the same thing over and over again. So I remember in my Facebook notes, I was writing, how come we haven't seen Trash Can Man yet? Like, it seems like he'd be fairly significant to this story. And I think that whoever wrote this miniseries or this movie agreed with me in that he's not that interesting as a character. He really just serves a purpose to deliver, spoiler, to deliver some bad stuff to Vegas later. So I appreciate that they've really undercut him. He has almost no footage in this movie. He's in there, like, he's goofy. He's so over the top and crazy. I don't even know what to make of him. I just know that I like that there's less of him.
Yeah, that is fair. What do you think about the change that they've made? I think in the book, he shows up with this nuclear bomb and it's like Flag didn't want him to do that. And it kind of screws with Flag's master plan. And here it seems like Flag is telling him to go get the nuclear bomb and bring it back to him. Yeah. What do you make of that change?
And can I add also that in the 94 miniseries, you see that Flag is like setting up an airfield where they're going to deliver this payload or a payload potentially to Boulder. But that has not yet been part of the 2020 version.
Yeah, they're making a lot of subtle changes here. And without knowing the ending, I don't know how it's going to pay off because I know the ending is going to be different here. We don't know what it's going to be. So I agree with Jessica 100%. They're kind of undercutting Flag as this master genius in that he's telling Trash Can Man to get the bomb. That is not in the book. The book, Trash Can Man goes rogue, and that's the problem. Flag can't control people like that.
Yeah, so I guess that now brings us back to the question we asked you at the top of this podcast, Mario. So with that change in mind, and with the, I think pretty much every time that Flag is supposed to have lost it, he kind of doesn't lose it. So how do you think that informs what we're going to see in the ending? And I would love to hear your speculations on how this is going to end.
Yeah, this is a tough one because I specifically don't read spoilers. I have no idea how it's going to end. I do know that, like most Stephen King books, the proper ending is to just cut out everything Stephen King did and make up your own ending because he cannot do endings. So, I think it's going to be pretty similar. I think the stand and the deaths and blah, blah, all that's going to be similar. I don't think there's going to be any shocks in what happens. But I think something after that will change. And because I know Stephen King said it's not so much a new ending, it's like a new coda at the end of the ending.
Yeah.
So there's going to be more with Franny and the baby and Stu. I think it's going to be more Boulder-centric than Las Vegas-centric.
Yeah.
That's my hunch.
I agree also, especially that Jess had said last week that the ninth episode is entitled something, the coda, whatever. So I do think that we're going to see a pretty straightforward, maybe like some details change here or there in next week's eighth episode. But I do think that the ninth episode, I think anything's on the table.
I'd agree. How about you, Jessica? Now, I'm putting you on the spot. What do you think?
Well, there are two different endings across the two different books. There's, you know, the abridged book ending where they have a, you know, it ends with the birth of Franny's child and Stu is there to like form the family unit. And then they're like ambiguous about, and it's a stupid ending. They're like, do you think we're really on the path to good? And like, I don't know. And that's pretty dumb. That's a very like 29-year-old man thinking he knows how the world works kind of ending. And then you have the expanded ending in the unabridged version where we get to see the little baby grow up a little bit and Franny and Stu are just so stifled by life in Boulder that they strike out on their own and decide to go back to Maine or whatever. And then you have a coda, which is maybe the dumbest thing Stephen King's ever written in an ending. And he's written a lot of really dumb endings where Randall Flagg didn't die in the nuclear blast. He is now showing up to mess with an uncontacted tribe somewhere, and he's going to build up civilization wherever he's at, like in the Amazon or whatever. And I really sincerely hope that Stephen King's idea of a new ending is not just filming this coda.
I would not be surprised, to be honest, because if you look at his, you know, his breadth of work, Flag is in like so many stories. The Flag in theory should be unkillable, so it would be very much on brand if Flag comes back at the end. Just pointing that out.
Yeah, I think it would be on brand, but I also I had a conversation a few weeks ago with Meg Ellison, who is an author who is, whose work is really very informed by The Stand, and who's been live tweeting this series to great humorous effect. And she said she, the thing she would like as a Stephen King obsessive who has a lot of affection for the source material and for Flagg as a character, she would love to see there be some kind of callback to all of the other places Flagg has shown up. And I agree with that. I want to see like some kind of Dark Tower homage to bring that all back together. And do you think that's likely?
I want to see the Eyes of the Dragon make an appearance. That would be awesome.
Yeah. Oh, man. I love that book, by the way.
You know, that was the first Stephen King book I ever read. If you know, if there was ever a better introduction to Stephen King, it's The Eyes of the Dragon, the children's book he wrote for his daughter.
Yeah, the book that's not at all like anything else he ever wrote.
Yeah. Again, I don't know. I think Flagg will be surviving. And the only reason I say that is because, A, it's on brand for Stephen King. It wasn't on brand in 1978 when he wrote the story, but it is now, because he's had so many things to Flagg since then. He's attached to Flagg. I think it may set up future Randall Flagg spinoffs of The Stand, which I kind of think might be the eventual endgame here. But the other thing is that I think they're really attached to this Skarsgård, the actor that plays Flagg, who I think is so infinitely better than the old Flagg in 94 that I can't believe this is even debatable. Mm-hmm. But I think they really like him and they're going to want to use him as much as possible. That's my guess.
So you think Flagg's getting a spinoff series?
I think they're going to leave that possibility because why wouldn't you? I mean, he's so charismatic. He's a great figure. He's in so many other Stephen King books. Okay. And they've done Castle Rock, which is, you know, the Stephen King universe, the expanded universe. Why not do a Randall Flagg one? There's so much source material they could work with in the future that I think if I were a producer, that's what I'd do.
Do you think there's a possibility for a Flaggiverse series with Sarsgaard's Flagg appearing in more series? And if so, what's the next project?
Yeah, I mean, I absolutely think there could, just because he's so dominant as that character that I could think there will be a demand. I don't know what the specifics will be. I actually haven't read all the Dark Tower books. My wife has read them all. I only got through four, so I don't know all his universe that much. I just know he's all over the place. But again, if you were a producer, could you resist doing that?
I suppose not. It makes a lot of sense. Do you think, is it possible we get a Dark Tower adaptation?
You mean better than the movie version?
Hey, the movie version is the 1994 miniseries equivalent.
Oh, that is the worst movie. I mean, of all the Stephen King movie adaptations, they took 7 Dark Tower books and squeezed them into a 90-minute movie. I do not understand the gall, the unmitigated gall and the audacity that they think they could do that.
Wow, there have been a lot of really bad Stephen King adaptations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can tell you, my wife, she is more forgiving on Stephen King movie adaptations and books than me. I'll give up on stuff if I don't like it. She will never give up anything. She's read every single thing, watched every single thing. The Dark Tower is the one that she hates the most. She's like, they didn't even try. That is the biggest steaming pile of crap I have ever seen.
Yeah, I have heard that. I actually have not. I read the first couple Dark Tower books when I was in the Stephen King fandom as a teenager, but I never got through the whole thing, and I've never tried the movie because I've heard exactly that.
Oh, yeah, it's like there's not, I don't know, I can't even explain how terrible it is. They just cut out basically 6.75 of the books. It's like 50 pages of one book. That's the entire movie.
Amazing.
Yeah, but I got it again. To get back to, I do think there will be a Randall Flagg spinoff at some point, just because I couldn't resist if I were making this show.
Yeah, but do you feel like that this has been enough of a success to warrant another adaptation where, like, set aside like how, well or not well it's been done? I feel like that as just like as a piece of commerce, like I don't think that it has performed very well, but it's on CBS All Access and we have no idea.
And again, whether edited as performed or not is irrelevant because it was filmed and edited before it was released. So they didn't know if it was going to be a hit or not.
And I think we also have to point out that it was filmed and edited well before it was extremely tone deaf to have a movie about a global pandemic that wipes out humanity.
Mm-hmm.
And to be fair, this hardly even went into the pandemic part. So I think they probably cognizantly cut down a lot of that in the first half of the story because of when it came out.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it was supposed to be a 10-part a series, but then they realized that they needed to cut out an entire hour of people coughing on each other.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And people refusing to wear masks. Yeah. No, there's no virus. False.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Fake news.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, to get to Rob's point, this is a bigger question. Will this be seen as a success one day? I don't think it's seen as a success now. I think it will one day. I think people just have to get used to it.
Yeah.
Hmm.
I believe that. I do think that it will have some sort of legs, potentially, like, oh, have you read The Stand? Oh, watch the, you know, now watch the, you know, 9-part miniseries from 2020. I just don't know if it's ever going to, like, we'll see anything else like this on CBS All Access or Paramount Plus.
No. And to be honest, I never thought I would see a full-length version of The Stand movie in my lifetime. I still don't. This is not that, but we're not going to get anything any bigger. So, I mean, it's either you like this or you don't. My argument is you can take every scene that was in the 94 version and compare to the exact same scene in this one, and it's better in this version almost every single time. So that's my argument. It's just, I think people are, their expectations are a little too high what they're going to get out of The Stand filmed.
Yeah, I think that's fair, Mario. I was surprised that they were even going to try after they already tried once. I mean, they being like people in TV globally. I could certainly see someone watching the 94 miniseries and saying, I'm going to fix that, and that. I'm going to excise Molly Ringwald and bring in someone who feels like a pregnant college student. We're going to, yeah. But
someone who actually, an actress who actually closes her mouth every 5 seconds. Mm-hmm. Molly's got that open mouth gape the entire time. It bugs me.
Yeah, there is that, but there's also, I feel like there's at least two iconic performances in that miniseries that were just actors doing the best they had with the material they got and really nailing the characters. And I would say that's Gary Sinise, obviously. Like, nobody's ever going to be Stu Redmond for me other than Gary Sinise. And then, like, weirdly, Tom Cullen was kind of exactly like he appears in the book. And this is a very different Tom Cullen we're getting now.
Yeah, and I will say that I'm going to give people a little history lesson they may not know if you're younger. When they announced they were doing a TV miniseries back in like 91, 92, the message boards, there were message boards back then, like AOL, Prodigy, there was a couple other places too. This was endless discussion who they were going to cast for all these Stand, because everyone had a vision in their head of who should be each character. And there's one actress, I don't remember her name. She was in the show Herman's Head. Do you remember Herman's Head?
Yes. I remember. Yes.
She was good. She was like the good virtue of the good girl. And I'm like, she should be Franny. I don't remember her name. I was always dead set she should be Franny. And I was so horrified they picked Molly Ringwald. What?
They went with the name.
Yeah. But the biggest outrage, and I got to bring this up, is Rob Lowe as Nick. People were ready to revolt that the guy who filmed the sex tape, again, people don't remember, he was a big scandal guy because he had an underage girl sex tape at the time. And it was like a career-ending thing. And they're like, he is the beloved Nick Andros? No way. So, like, I think he turned in one of the iconic performances in the first one, too. Much to everyone's horror, nobody thought he could have done it.
I think this was Rob Lowe's, like, his turnaround moment. This was his comeback. This was his John Travolta in Pulp Fiction, to bring it back to Pulp Fiction.
Yeah, it was literally his comeback.
Yeah, literally the greatest performance of Rob Lowe in the 90s.
Yeah, no, I think there were three standout performances in the 94 one. Gary Sinise, obviously, again, to put this in historical context, before a lot of people knew who Gary Sinise was, before Forrest Gump. You only knew him from maybe Of Mice and Men, and that was about
it. Yeah, this was, I think, spring 94, and then summer 94 was going to be Forrest Gump, right?
Yeah, so this is the year of Gary Sinise, 94. And then Rob Lowe pulling this great performance out of his butt that nobody thought would ever happen. And then I love Tom Cullen. And it was funny because this was back in 92, 93, the message boards. People would say, you know who they should get to play Tom Cullen? That Dauber guy from Coach. Everyone said that. That's exactly who they got.
Yeah, it's kind of amazing. Like, reading the book, I was, you know, I picked up the book after I saw the first hour of the miniseries. And I'm reading this and I'm like, oh, wow, that's exactly what Tom Cullen looks like in miniseries. That's kind of great.
Yeah,
but I'm fascinated by the fact that there was an internet community about this back then. Like, where there's barely an internet.
No, there was a lot of message board. AOL had chat rooms. Prodigy, I was big on the Prodigy message boards. And again, this was a huge subject of discussion. This was the book that everyone talked about. This was like, you know, if you go on a Survivor message board, what's your all-time dream cast? This is every single Stephen King message board. What's your all-time Stan dream cast? So this was all anybody would talk about back in the day. Although I do think there was one more performance in the 94 one that I thought was especially good. And that was Julie Lawrie, Shawnee Smith. I love her in that original version. She's so perfect. And I like her more than this new Julie. And I've heard other people argue with me. They like this new Julie because she has more to do. But I'm like, nobody ever had better crazy eyes than Shawnee Smith. She was awesome.
Yeah, I loved her performance there, too. Oh, there's another casting choice that I'm curious to get your thoughts on, Mario. How about Greg Kinnear as Glenn Bateman? Mm-hmm. What do you think about the change there? And I think part of it is the fact that Stephen King didn't know what an old person was when he was writing the novel because he was 29 years old and thought 57 sounded like one foot in the grave. But, you know, we got 80-year-old Ray Walston turning in one of the performances of his career in the miniseries. Like, he's as good as Rob Lowe for what he turned in. And then we get Greg Kinnear, who's now like this sort of late middle-aged stoner. What's your take on that?
Okay, my short answer is I love Greg Kinnear. I think he is the single greatest change to this miniseries because he is absolutely perfect what Glenn Bateman is supposed to be. But that being said, I love Ray Walston in the original, even though he's nothing like what Glenn should be. But for what Ray Walston's doing with it, I think he's very good.
You know, when Mother Abigail says, head out on foot, don't take any food, don't take any water, but vape pen is okay? That was deemed okay. Like, hey, she didn't say, don't take the vape pen. I think we're good on this.
You know, Rob, that everybody else was like, yeah, you know what? I've been around you when you're off the vape pen. You can definitely bring that with you.
Mm-hmm.
I also like the loophole. No food, no water, to which Glenn says, all right, in the next town, we'll just stop at the first grocery store. Which yeah. I don't think is what she intended. I think she intended for them to hunt and get their own food. But no, Ray or Glenn finds the loophole. But yeah, I love Glenn Bateman in this one. I love Greg Kinnear. I think there's two additions or three additions to this one that are so incredible that really make this one better than 94. The number one on my list is Greg Kinnear as Glenn Bateman, because that is exactly what Glenn Bateman should be. He's bitter. He's pissy. He's seen it all. He's not impressed by any of this, but he's like, you know what? Screw it. I got to be the smart one here because nobody else is, but he doesn't want to do it. And that's Glenn Bateman to me.
Yeah. I love that. I can definitely get on board with that. I think he's turning in a great performance. It's jarring, I think, to people who have that much affection, like who really internalized the 94 miniseries like I did, probably to a fault. It's been an adjustment for sure.
Yeah, I understand. You prefer Mr. Hand from Fast Times. I get it.
Yes. My favorite Martian is Glenn Bateman to me.
Can you attend my stand? It is for your own benefit. Yeah, no, I think he has been the greatest improvement, Glenn Bateman. I think Harold Lauder has been the other greatest improvement just because Parker Lewis was so miscast and terrible. But the other one is Larry.
Mm-hmm.
Only because
yes.
Larry is such a boring non-entity in both the book and the 94 version.
Agreed.
And you remember him in this one. It's going to be, I hate to spoil this, it's going to be very sad when he dies in this one finally.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, you kind of don't care when the two characters that die at the end of the miniseries and at the end of the book die. Yeah. It's like, oh, I guess they kind of had to, but there's no, like, it doesn't feel like sacrifice the way that this is going to.
Yeah, oh no, Larry and Ralph. No, stop, don't come back. This is going to be heart-wrenching when Larry dies. That's what I'm trying to get across to people. Larry being so much more relevant and just there and different from the, like, in the movie 94 version, he's just some generic white guy. I don't even know anything about him. He's not interesting at all. Like, his story is so much deeper in this one. It's going to be really sad when he dies, and I think it'll make people reconsider a lot of what they thought about the stand up to that when they realize how affecting it's going to be now.
Yeah, he's like a dollar store Springsteen in the 94 version.
Yeah.
In fact, in 91 and 92, that's who people suggested should play Larry Underwood. They should get Bruce Springsteen.
The boss.
Yeah. I can believe that. Yeah, it's just like, oh, look at me. It's August and I've got a leather jacket, so clearly I'm tough.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I couldn't believe that Larry, you know, they're on this journey and what month is it? November when they're out on the road, December.
Yeah.
And they're out on the road, and then he's like, all right, I got to go see what's going on with Harold. It's like, we got to cover the body. Takes his leather jacket off. I'm like, all right, let me just cover Harold's face with my jacket. I know I'm, you know, walking to Vegas in the middle of the winter, but, you know, can't let the vultures do with him what they would, as Mother Nature intended.
Good callback. I like that.
Yeah, I like that.
Although, did you like Harold getting a redemption in this? Because he does not in 94. I personally like that they call back the whole Larry following Harold across the country. He's got some loyalty to Harold. Although, admittedly, asterisk, we never saw any of that. We just had Larry talk about it. But it'd be nice if we would have seen that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would have loved that, too. And I think you do get... You get Larry seeing that in the miniseries. You see him following the signs. You don't get any payoff with it.
Payday.
Where here, we got the payday, but we didn't get the actual lead into it. And I feel like they also, I don't think the book calls back to that when they find Harold's body.
They don't. It was a good addition, I think.
It's a great addition. I clocked that as well. I thought, this is really nice because it reminds you that Harold had a lot of reasons to be here besides to blow people up.
Yeah, and he was a hero.
Yeah. And it was one of my favorite things that in the book that Larry was following these signs and he had in his head this idea of who Harold Lauder must be. And then he meets him and he's like, oh, wow, this is kind of even cooler because you're just a fat 16-year-old kid and you did all this and you saved me. And then you never get it a callback to it again. And here they gave you that callback that I think we very much needed.
Well, yeah, and that's one thing I've said since day one. You can always tell whoever wrote this show, the producers, they have great affection and knowledge of the source material, and they're trying their best to include the stuff they think is necessary and cut out the part, the stuff they think isn't. And it's kind of a thankless job. They're never going to win with The Stand, unfortunately. Yeah. You can't win, but it's like you had different problems. The 94 one, you had all the lead up, but no payoff. This one has none of the lead up, just the payoff. So it's like they both err in different ways.
So do you think giving them more time might help it?
Of course. I think The Stand should be a daily show on 365 days of the year. I would love it.
Wow.
That's not the reality of The Stand. You can't do that. But any time you give The Stand is going to be better because obviously it's a 1,300-page book.
Yeah. I can't wait for the Ratman flashback episode.
Okay. I do have to point out one huge flaw in this new version. And I've been very high on this new version.
Okay.
I think there's very few flaws in it. I think it's about as good as you can do under the circumstances. But they cut out Larry's wife.
Yes. Thank you.
Yeah. There's a ripple of that. Let me point this out for people who don't know the book. Larry, He's a womanizer, kind of a creep. He just uses women for sex. He's rich. He tries to get away from that. His mom tries to get him away from that. He never does. He hooks up with Rita. He uses her. She dies. He feels bad because he was kind of responsible. Then he hooks up with Nadine. And then she turned out to be the devil, the wife of the devil. So Larry's not good with women. He has no long-term, you know, potential as a character. He eventually hooks up with this lady, Lucy Swan, who becomes his wife, and they become a stable family, and they raise Joe together, because when Nadine leaves, they kind of take over of Joe. You cut Lucy out of this story, which they have done, it changes Larry's story pretty significantly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so here, the ripple effect is that then, who is watching Joe when all of this is going on?
Exactly. That's my wife's point as well. The moms always notice this stuff. Who the hell is watching Joe? And like when Nadine leaves, Larry's like, well, hey, Joe, I guess I'll take you in. But that there's no resonance to that scene because he and Lucy have not been raising Joe all along. So there's no relationship between Larry and Joe, really.
Yeah, you kind of just take out all of Larry's relationships. I don't even think he really had a relationship with Nadine.
Yeah, like, we didn't see that either.
I was kind of calling it like, oh, they, you know, he was just the hot guy she carpooled with.
They had the one scene that was at like the baseball stadium.
Yeah. Yeah. But that was about it.
That was it.
He was her Uber driver.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. But that's my only real flaw. I like almost everything they're doing with the story right now. All the changes they made. I can see why they're doing it. I see we're setting it up for a nice payoff, but they really did Nick dirty. I've almost forgot to mention Nick on this podcast. I even forget he was in this version. And then Larry, Larry is interesting, but they cut out some of Larry's side story that I think would have helped a lot.
Yeah, Larry doesn't get to change. It's like he was a cool rock star before, and he's still a cool rock star, damn it.
Yeah. I like when he goes to spy on Harold's house when Franny calls him in. Of course, Larry's not busy. Larry's not out scoring with girls or doing anything on a party on a Friday night. He's the one guy sitting at home all by himself reading a book.
Yeah. And then ironically, that's the time when a girl does come over and try to score with him. And his reason for rejecting her is he has to go break into someone else's house.
She's not acting like herself.
No.
Well, yeah. Okay, now going back to the ripple effect. You take one thing out, it changes other things. The whole point of Larry and Nadine is that she wouldn't sleep with him. That was the thing. They were a couple, but she couldn't have sex with him on the road because she's saving herself for Flag. So Larry is, you know, pent up and kind of blue-balled. And so when he gets to Boulder, now he hooks up with Lucy. Now he's got a wife, and now he can be like a normal guy, a human male. And so when Nadine comes back and says, I want you to sleep with me now, that's a big moment in the book because Nadine, he's been wanted that the whole time, but we never had any of that lead up in this one. Again, certain things, you take one thing out, it affects the story later.
And then that also affects Nadine's arc because Nadine never feels the pull to stay in Boulder either.
Yeah, nothing.
Nothing. It's like, oh, I got to go. I'm going to go be with Flag. Bye. She kind of like half-heartedly throws herself at Larry. Oh, no. Oh, that's not going to work. Okay. Bye.
Yeah.
Yeah,
none of this makes me like it less. I just find it more interesting. I'm fascinated to think of which story changes they've made and why and what effect it has. But it doesn't make me like the story less. I think it's great for what it's doing.
Yeah, I mean, there's certainly, I can't think of anything that I've watched in the past year. And I have covered 8 different TV shows in the past year. And I can't think of any that give me more to talk about and pick apart. I will say that it has been a very fun journey because of that.
And isn't that what art is supposed to do at the long run? Makes you generate discussion.
It's been very interesting the whole way through.
Yeah, that's what post-show recaps is supposed to do anyway.
Mm-hmm. I have been kind of shocked that people were that vehemently, you know, visceral towards their hatred towards this right from the start. I'm like, it's going to be different, admittedly. They're jumping around in time. Okay, it's weird. The timeline's weird, but at least don't you want to stick with it and see where it's going? That's why I'm so surprised at Wiggler, you know, rage quitting so quickly. Like, don't you want to see where it's going to go?
I mean, I can't say I don't at this point. I'm with it for the long haul. I got to see how they pull it off. And I want to see them kind of, I mean, I admittedly, I like it less than you do, Mario, but I want to see if they can pull out of this tailspin.
Ah, no, you want to see if they can keep ascending to heaven.
But Jess, do you feel like that this episode was part of that tailspin? Because I feel like that this was the strongest episode, I think, that maybe since like the second episode. I even though Mario, that's his least favorite.
No, I don't think they've had a bad episode since the second one.
I feel like there's just too much of this that I feel like from a character point of view, like these are the characters I wanted to be with all along. Mm-hmm. I certainly feel like I know these people in a way that I haven't known them for 6 episodes prior to this. And I think they've done this part of it. Like this stand area, I think is the part that, like you said, Mario, it's to them, it's the most important part. It's the thing that they've just, everything else has been leading up to it. Mm-hmm. But I also think that it laid bare a lot of the things that are wrong with this adaptation that, like all of the places where they glossed over it, there you see where they should have done it differently.
Yeah. They perhaps yada yadded over different parts than I would have yada yadded over.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Exactly. I think it's just selective yada yadding at this point.
Yeah. Yeah, but I agree with you. It's again, if I'm the producer of this version of The Stand, we get to the end here. I care about Ray enough. I mean, I don't really know who she is, but she's got some presence. I like her. She's spunky. She's better than Ralph. Larry is so much more interesting than he has ever been at any point in any version of The Stand. Mm-hmm. I'm going to care when he dies. It's going to be it's going to be the Nick moment, I think, in this one.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Stu is not as interesting as Gary Sinise, but you know what? Stu isn't that important to the ending. So I kind of don't mind that.
He's fine.
Yeah, he's all right.
And then who else? Glenn, I think, is so much better. So, like, I think we have the proper combination of characters in the proper ways they should be set up. I care about Flag. Flag isn't a buffoon. Flag is genuinely scary in this one. I want to see him just go mad ass on them and go crazy. Trash Can Man has been negated enough that I don't have to worry about him. The only big change that I don't get at all is, I guess we haven't talked about Lloyd yet.
Lloyd sucks, Mario.
Lloyd's the worst. He doesn't even do anything. Why is Lloyd there?
I can't defend Lloyd. I like Lloyd in the book. I this is a discussion I've had with my wife many times, that I think the two most complex, interesting character arcs in the book are Harold and Lloyd.
Yep.
And she's never understood why I like Lloyd in the book. I'm like, he just has depth in the book, and there's none of that in this. But I liked him in the 94 version, although I'm not entirely sure that was the same Lloyd as the book. So we're all over the place with Lloyd, where he is now just a gay pimp, apparently.
Yeah, it used to be that Lloyd went from someone who got dragged along on this crime spree and was like morally questionable to someone who kind of rose to competence and was doing good things for Flag, and then realized that he had this great growth arc, but he backed the wrong guy. And the very last minute, he's like, oh shit, I backed the wrong guy. Mm-hmm. And here it's like, why do we care? He's just a guy that likes to party.
Yeah. I mean, to me, he's a huge misstep, but he's also an interesting misstep because it's so wildly different. So
yeah,
I can at least respect they had the balls to do that. I don't think it works, but you know, at least they went with it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. They went hard.
I'm not picturing this guy at the end of his life looking up and saying, oh, I backed the wrong guy.
Mm-hmm. Well, if he does, we won't care. That's the bigger problem.
That is the bigger problem. There's no sympathy for him. He's not complex. He just likes partying.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, one thing I've noticed is they've made all the Vegas characters cartoon caricatures. Julie is so over the top. Lloyd is so over the top. The only one who's not is Flag. So, I mean, and Nadine is now completely over the top after this last episode. The white hair, the pulsating belly. So, I think they're just trying to focus on Flag as the only real threat. And I would guess, just from a storytelling perspective, that's their logic. Everyone else is so silly, but Flag is not. And you have to realize that he's deadly serious.
You know, can I talk about Nadine real quick about that? Just that I feel like that there's been a shift in Nadine from at least the 1994 version. And again, I don't remember exactly the details of the book, but in the 94 version, Nadine sleeps with Flag finally. Instant regret. She knows, like, I've made a terrible mistake. She's in the car with Flag, and like he's acting like kind of cutesy with her, and she's just like, she's miserable. She's like talking back to him by the time she gets to Vegas, and she's at like creeping everybody out. She seems like fully on board with this, you know, especially now that she has like this full term pregnancy going on. I just wonder, when is the shift going to come for Nadine?
Yeah, that's interesting. That's a good point, because I'm not entirely sure if their choice is going to be effective. Like, you want Nadine to be three-dimensional and have an arc, growth arc, you know, like Lloyd, Harold, stuff, but I don't know if she's going to.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they're not setting up Flag for a fall, because that was one of the dominoes in the fall of Flag.
Yeah.
Like, he impregnates her, and then she's so horrified at what she's done, she kills herself. Like, she kills herself now. Like, why do we care? And, you know, Lloyd realizing that he's backed the wrong guy, and then Trash Can Man showing up with the bomb is like the last domino of Flag's downfall. And it's like Flag is not getting any of those beats now. He's not getting a downfall.
Yeah. Do you think that we're going to get a Larry and Nadine conversation here? Because they've sent Nadine down to go meet Larry, which was not something that happened in the 94 version. And is he going to have some sort of a come to Jesus moment with her about like, how could you do this? You left Joe. What have you done to yourself? She's like, you're right. I really screwed up.
A huge mistake.
Yeah.
She got turned into Joe Bluth.
Yeah.
No, I don't think we are, only because they have negated the Larry and Nadine story so much that I don't think there's any reason for them to have her much of a redemption.
But why have her greet him?
Just to give Nadine something to do. Mm-hmm. I think that's what they're doing. They're just trying to give these female characters more to do because they don't do much in the book.
Mm-hmm.
That's my cynical take on that. They're just giving her something to do.
Yep. I think this is part of my problem with it, that they don't really know what to do with some of these characters, and they just kind of give them a job.
Mm-hmm.
They're like the human resources lady that we met in Vegas.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Yeah. And we're all Tom Collins just watching.
I just wonder if then there's going to be some sort of a conversation that's going to turn her around in some way, because that ultimately, if she is going to, you know, turn on Flag, like, or realize that something has happened, like, there needs to be some sort of like incident or conversation that ends up changing her opinion.
Yeah, we'll see. Again, there's only really one episode left for a lot to happen, and then the coda. So, again, if having sex with a guy with an icicle for the penis doesn't change her mind, I don't know if anything will.
Hmm. Is that how that works?
Not to be That's how, if I believe in the book, that it's very cold, it's like an icicle, and that's what changes her mind. She's like, oh my God, this hurts. Yeah.
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 And I want to thank you guys for giving me the episode with the rape scene. So thank you very much for putting that on my...
You're welcome.
Yeah. We didn't really talk about Stu's fall and the abandoning Stu scene.
Yeah, this is interesting because for people who read the book, that's almost a little Nick moment when Nick blows up because Mother Abigail says, one of you won't make it. And you assume it's going to be Ralph because nobody gives a shit about Ralph.
Yeah.
And in the book, it's like Stu falls. And you're like, oh, he was the one who doesn't make it. So you think he's going to die. Again, he won't. But that's like a big moment in the book. I always kind of forget that that's kind of yada-yadded over in most discussions of The Stand.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, it's like the third one of the people you think are going to confront Flag, and they just end up not. So
he did get further than Harold, though, so I'll give him that. Once again, he has topped Harold Lauder.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's like Harold Lauder is the Chester Copperpot of this whole odyssey.
One thing that they did take away that I actually liked here also was from in the 94 version, like Stu is able to he's like, I feel a disturbance in the force. Harold has killed himself. Wait, since when does Stu have supernatural powers?
That's the Lieutenant Dan in him. He's like Mac Taylor, Detective Mac Taylor.
Something's happened. Yeah.
Yeah. The supernatural.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. They have really toned down Stu in this version, which again, I could see the obvious thing is, well, James Marsden isn't quite as affecting an actor as Gary Sinise, but I think the bigger picture is there. Stu isn't actually all that important to the story, to be honest, once they get to Boulder.
You know what? Stu really could be, he could be like the Indiana Jones of it all. You could take him out of the story and everything happens exactly the same way.
Mm-hmm.
That's a good point. I like that. Yeah, I've noticed that the more I've paid attention to The Stand, that Stu is only important to when they get to Boulder. And once they get there, Glenn kind of takes over the committee. You know, Larry in this version is the speaker at the committee. Like, Stu isn't really doing that much. He's not the leader of anything. Yeah.
Maybe he's got a big part to play in the after this is all over.
It could be. We'll see what they're going to do with Marsden, but he is not really the big star of this movie, despite Gary Sinise being the biggest star in the original, but that's just because Sinise was such a good actor.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. I think maybe Sinise ascribes more importance to him than he otherwise would have had.
Mm-hmm.
Bingo. You got it.
Do you think that Glenn was irresponsible with Kojak the dog?
How so?
I believe in the 94 version, I believe they leave Kojak with Stu. In this case, they make it that Glenn just loses Kojak.
Yeah.
And then gets
Kojak
abducted.
Goes rogue.
Yeah.
He's an irresponsible dog owner.
Yeah. It's very much in the book. Yeah. Very much in the book and 94, they leave. It's not so much that they leave Kojak there. I think in the book, Kojak chooses to stay and they all know what's happening.
Yeah. Because he goes and catches rabbits and brings them. What a well-trained dog.
Yeah. Kojak gets very good treatment in the book. Like, I think he even gets a love interest.
Whoa.
Wow. They found a female. It's like an airplane getting a female autopilot at the end. She shows up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
I don't remember that.
Yeah, they find another dog and they're like, oh, wow, we can have puppies.
Glenn's like, well, I should have never taken him off the leash. Like, the dog wasn't on the leash one time the entire movie.
Yeah.
My wife was laughing at that line, too. I shouldn't have taken him off the leash. When was he on a leash?
Yeah.
Yeah, but I think it is kind of on brand for this version of Glenn. He's like, you know what? Fuck it. Society dies. Dogs run away. Who cares? I'll get another dog.
He's like, wait, what was I just talking about? Where's the dog? We had the dog, right?
I'll tell you a story here. I'm not going to name names. I don't want to sell people out. But like I said, I have prison pen pals, a lot of people that I write to and I help with their college degrees and stuff. And I send them this book. And I always want to know their thoughts on The Stand. And unfortunately, people in prison tend not to be the deepest thinkers. They don't really get themes and stuff a lot of the time because they generally don't have the strongest education. That's why they're there in the first place. So one of my latest pen pals, I sent this and their response to The Stand. Like, what did you think? What is your takeaway from The Stand? And their one takeaway was, wow, Kojak's a good dog.
Mm.
Like, that's not really the biggest message I wanted you to get from the book.
Yeah. He's a good dog. Loyal.
Yes. Loyal. That was their takeaway. It's the Kojak story with some side characters.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we already figured out that Stu is not the main hero of the story. Maybe it really is Kojak.
Yeah. Okay. Well, then who is? Is Larry? I mean, if you read The Stand, it's pretty evident that Stephen King is very high on Larry Underwood being his star.
Mm-hmm.
And that never comes across in any adaptation. I think he always expected Larry to be the biggest star of this story.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if he really wanted that to happen, maybe he shouldn't have had a rock star named Larry.
I know this is probably more of a conversation for next week, and for all the spoiler people, please, I implore you to skip ahead like 2 minutes, if we could. But is anybody the hero? Isn't the ending like a complete deus ex machina?
Yes.
What,
like literally,
you have a problem with the hand of God literally reaching down and squeezing the bomb. You don't like that?
Yeah,
I got a big problem with that.
I always dislike that.
Everyone has. There's not been one person, aside from the ending of It. The Stand is the worst ending of any Stephen King book.
And why did Larry and Ray being there, needing to be there, what does that, how did that happen?
Well, because it forces everyone to gather in the Times Square for their execution. Otherwise, the nuclear bomb would only take out part of Vegas. I don't know. It's, again, Stephen King has always said that this book was like his own personal Vietnam, that it just went on and on, and he hated it. He didn't like writing it. He had no idea how to end it. And it's very evident when you read it, he's just like, fuck it, just blow everyone up. And that's the end of the book.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and he's had 40 years to think about how he should have ended it. So maybe he did come up with something in those 40 years, or maybe he was too busy writing more books about main characters who are writers who have suffered trauma.
Well, how about this? Like, what if Larry, shoots the nuke with a gun next week, and it's actually like an act of a heroic act.
Larry ex machina?
Yeah.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah, well, I mean, does that make it better? I think probably it does.
Yeah, Larry's like, I was a sniper in the army for 8 years. We didn't mention that in the story, but I could take out that nuclear bomb way up here in this tower.
Are you saying that Larry should be Randy Quaid in Independence Day?
Yes. Nobody should be Randy Quaid ever, but I think that, they have him there, and then he, is able to, wrestle a gun away, and then shoots the nuke and blows it up. Like, Mother Abigail put them there, but it's actually the actions of the hero that ultimately destroys Vegas.
I actually like that ending. That would be, Randall Flagg, I have one thing to say to you, sir. Up yours! And he shoots him. That would be cool. I would applaud that ending if they could change it that much. Because again, it's a terrible ending. Mm-hmm. It always has been.
Yeah. I would get behind that. It's better. It's not great, but it's better.
Mm-hmm.
I always liked the book. Okay, just pointing out flaws in the book. Again, the greatest book of all time, but it's got flaws. All books do. I always love that they send spies, and the spies do nothing.
Nothing.
There's no point to the spies. Then there's like, oh, let's send four people instead. Let's send our entire committee.
Well, this is something that this is one of the things that they didn't like when they're making the series. They figured out the spies really don't have a point except to send Tom Cullen there to pick up Stu on his way back. Mm-hmm. But they kind of baked into that sending the spies is the thing that makes Mother Abigail realize that this is going off course and that people aren't listening to her. So then she goes on walkabout. Mm-hmm. And they really underlined that. I think it's sort of casually implied in the book, but they really drive that point home, and it actually drives the story a little bit, which I liked that a little bit better.
That's a solid point. I agree with you. Yeah, it's they're fixing a couple problems with the book. And I know Stephen King devotees don't want to hear that, but there are problems in this book that needed fixing.
Yeah, it's just that they did it at the expense of other things that didn't need breaking.
Yeah, again, it's a 9-hour miniseries. It's not much longer than the 94 one. People think it's so much longer, but it's really not. So you're going to add stuff, you're going to delete stuff at the same time. It's just you choose which ones are most important to you.
I guess so. So is there anything else we need to talk about before we start wrapping things up?
We have not mentioned one character in this miniseries, and it's the one character I cannot make up my mind if I like them or don't like them, and that's Franny. Everyone else I have an opinion on pretty drastically. Even Nadine I've come around on. She's different. But I see what they're doing with her, and they're, Amber Heard's trying her best with this very complex, perhaps doesn't really work character, but they're trying. Franny, I don't get.
Yeah, they've given Franny more to do here, but I think there's really no reason for her to be there except to sort of be the counterpoint, like she's carrying the good child and Nadine is carrying the evil child, maybe?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. And in the book, that's driven home over and over. For people who haven't read the book,
yeah,
it's driven home over and over that Franny is the only future that society has because she's the pregnant one. It's a major, major, major plot point if this baby is going to be immune or not. Because if it's not immune, then that's the end of society. So she is hugely important, and we're not really talking about that too much.
Mm.
Yeah. They really, like, there's no reason for her to even be pregnant. Like, they never mention it. She's just sort of waddling around with a basketball on her tummy. They gave
it's
her, like, yeah, it's not moving. And
so it's a good baby. Good babies don't move.
Yeah, the good babies don't move. Yeah, there's really not a lot that she gets to do, although they gave her, like, she can be an interpreter for Nick, which I thought was better than having him just use notepads because obviously he's deaf and he knows how to sign. But that really still doesn't give her anything to do herself. You got the plot point where she breaks into Harold's basement, which is okay. But then it's like, oh, you're 6 months pregnant and you have a head injury. You obviously can't go make the titular stand. You got to stay here. I don't know. I think there was still room for improvement. I liked Franny in the book. I thought it was one of Stephen King's more strongly written female characters, but there's still more to be done. The casting is good. I think the actress is good. I think she's closer to Franny than Molly Ringwald was.
How dare you? No, yeah. Yeah, anybody, they could have picked Parker Lewis to play Franny. He would have been better than Molly Ringwald. But yeah, I could not stand her in the original miniseries. She's good in the book. In fact, I'll give you a little trivia question. Back in 91, 92 on these message boards, that was, it's funny that people think that people back in the early days of the technology were so primitive. They had no, you know, deep thoughts. This was a very prominent debate that happened on almost every Stephen King or literary message board. Is Stephen King a sexist? Has he ever written a good, strong female character? This was something that dogged Stephen King for many years. And Franny was like the one you could point out. Franny's like, there's one female character that's pretty strong in his early novels. It's Franny.
Mm-hmm.
And so she was the one. So she's important to the Stephen King history of female characters. Again, I'm not entirely sure if I like her or don't like her in this one. She's better than Molly Ringwald. I like the scene when they were at dinner and she told the story where Harold tricked her in telling the story. That was very well acted. And so I like that scene. I like that little tension between them. But I'm still not 100% sure I'm on board with this Franny, even though, again, it's better than what we had before.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm with you. I don't really know what to make of her either. I like that they played up the relationship that she has with Harold ahead of time, because I feel like that's one of the more interesting things about her. She's the only person that has an existing relationship with someone that predates the apocalypse.
Mm-hmm.
And Stephen King never mentions that. He kind of doesn't care about that after a certain point either.
Mm-hmm. Changing the topic a little bit here. A lot of people have pointed this out to me. Is Harold Lauder supposed to be young Stephen King? Was Stephen King just a dick when he was a kid like Harold? Because they're very similar if you know Stephen King's backstory.
I mean, every Stephen King novel has to have a character who's a writer.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't tell if, like, Stephen King really felt pieces of himself in Harold as a teenage boy, or if he just realized late in the game that he didn't put a writer in.
Yeah, but that's something people have pointed out to me over the years, that out of all the writers and all the Stephen King stories, the two that are probably the closest to Stephen King in real life are Harold in The Stand and Jack Torrance in The Shining. And those are probably very autobiographical characters if you look into them a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I could dig that.
Can you dig your man, though?
I can dig my man.
Yeah, so I'm glad we talked about Franny, because I don't know what to make of Franny.
Yeah, there's really not much to talk about where Franny is concerned. And that's a shame, because there's more they could have done.
Yep. And again, just wanted to throw that out there, that for years, she was the trivia question. Can Stephen King write a sympathetic female character? She was pretty much the only one for most of the early novels.
Yeah, and then he tried to rebel against this by writing Rose Matter and just sort of proved his point.
You know, he's tried hard over the years.
Yeah, I'll give him a little medal that says you tried.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I want to prove my Stephen King nerd cred here. I may out-nerd you guys on this one. There was one other female character that I always loved in early Stephen King stories, and I always used her as an answer to the trivia question, can Stephen King write a strong female character? Do you guys know Different Seasons?
Yeah.
The Breathing Method, Sandra Stanfield.
Yes.
There you go. You know what I'm talking about.
The one unfilmable Different Seasons story.
I think that actually might be the best of the four stories in that book, too.
I agree. I love that one.
All right. So everyone, Mara, I don't know if Rob knows this one. You might not be as... Yeah, there's a book called Different Seasons. He wrote four kind of non-horror stories in 1982. One's Stand By Me, which I think is a really not very good story that turned into a really good movie.
Yep.
The Shawshank Redemption is in there.
Mm-hmm.
Apt Pupil, which is fantastically evil that I could not believe they tried to make that a movie in the 90s. And it's terrible, by the way, but it's a great story. And then the one at the end is called The Breathing Method, about this single mother in the 20s who's trying to raise a child in the sexist society where single mothers aren't supposed to exist, and she's going to do anything to make sure her child is born into the world. I think it's a really good story. People should check that out.
Yeah. Also, even more unfilmable than Apt Pupil, but...
Yeah, we won't spoil it.
Yeah. For sure. All right. So I think we have... really exhausted everything we have come here to talk about. Unless you guys think of anything else, like on the, you know, at the very last 11th hour before the hand of God comes and detonates this podcast.
I'm good.
No, I think we've covered it pretty much in toto. I think we're good. I just want to get across to people that I really hope you realize how much discussion we've generated just in this episode alone. And again, most TV shows don't do that anymore. So whether you like or don't like The Stand, I happen to think it's a minor masterpiece. You don't necessarily have to agree with me. I really hope you think about it, and this is something that lodges in your brain, and you do discuss this version many times in the future, because I do think this might be the best version we will ever get in our lifetimes, even though, again, asterisk, it's not perfect.
Yeah, Mario, you're talking to two people who basically analyze television shows for a living.
I know. So. This is more for the other people. I know. Yeah, I'm not talking to you guys so much. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, all right. That's fair. So, Mario, where can we find you out in the world?
Oh, goodness. Where can you not find me these days? The Funny 115, that's my big project. I am... been working on this, or it's a compilation of the funniest Survivor moments of all time. That's how I met Jessica. That's how I met Rob. It's over the years. I've been doing this for like 15 years. Mm-hmm. This is like,
we
this
met
huge...
before the Funny 115.
Yeah, I know Rob from way back. Well, but eventually I started writing about him for mm-hmm. the Funny 115 and about him and stuff. So I was one of Rob's early. One of your early cheerleaders of Rob Sestrino. Mm-hmm. I'm like, this guy's amazing.
Mario, it is worth noting that you are the connector between me and Rob. I mean, apart from me having watched Survivor, I found the Funny 115, and you talked about Rob a lot and mentioned the fishbowl, which led me to like, oh, Rob is Rob still doing stuff?
Oh, and then it so happened you're saying to be, that Mario is like the Mother Abigail of,
yes.
Of Rob as a podcast?
No, I'm saying Mario is the Randall Flagg of Rob as a podcast.
But I bake my own bread. Have I made that clear over 50 pages in a row? I bake my own goddamn bread. Yeah, no, I've been writing about Survivor and reality TV forever. Again, we all kind of intersect and interrelate in some way. But the Funny 115, it's funny115.com, my big project. I am about to wrap it up. 15 years of work. I don't ever want to write another entry again because it's thousands and thousands and thousands of pages and jokes and stuff.
You have said that after every installment.
I know. I eventually I start saying if they want me to keep going, they'll have to pay me at a certain point because of the hundreds and thousands of hours I put into these things. But I'm working on an entry right now about, you guys will love this one, especially you, Jessica, probably, how Dan Foley is one of the greatest Survivor characters of all time.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a big magnum opus. It's like 150 page entry I'm working on right now.
Jeez.
It's fun. Yeah, I hold nothing back in this one. I can throw everything I can at the wall to get people to win over on Dan Foley.
I'll clear my calendar.
Besides that, I have a podcast, Staff Picks, which is dedicated to underloved movies that I really just try to get people to appreciate stuff they might not have appreciated before on a different level. And I try to throw whatever I can, try to get smart people on there, people that have a passion for a movie that nobody else likes. And you can find that at staffpicks.podbean.com. I'm really proud of that show, even though it's not as listened to as Rob has a podcast. But I've had Rob on there before.
What is?
Jessica on there twice.
What is, Mario? Yeah, really, when you think about
exactly.
it.
Exactly. I didn't want to come right out and say that you're a god, Rob. I was trying to hide and not mention that.
I'm a close associate. I'm not a god.
Yeah, but Rob has recently committed to being on Staff Picks to talk about Westworld, so that's good.
Yeah, we want to talk about Stew.
Yeah. So, you can find me at Staff Picks, Funny 115. I have a podcast out there about the history of Survivor called The Survivor Historians, which is probably what most people know me from these days. That's not Rob has a podcast, but that's so much bigger than than staff picks. You can find that at survivorhistorians.podbean.com. We just walk through the history of the show, explain everything you need to know about Survivor, why it was important in context, why the show was received the way it was, and we have lots of inappropriate dick jokes. It's very informal, so it's a fun show.
Yeah. Hey, if Survivor doesn't film again, you're going to catch up to Survivor on the Survivor Historians.
Well, it's crazy because now, you know, Survivor just dropped on Netflix. And so now all these people are trying to get into Survivor history, and they're all getting funneled to Survivor Historians or yours, the Evolution of Strategy. And I'm like, wow, this is all of a sudden, we have this huge market for, like, we're the only game in town of explaining to people why this was important. So, yeah, we have all these new viewers. If you're just getting this Survivor, look for Survivor Historians. I do that show exactly for you. You're the person I do it for.
That's amazing, Mario. Rob, what's going on this week? Speaking of Survivor history, I know you just dropped a podcast about an important moment in Survivor history.
Boy, Mario, I'm not sure how much you've covered Survivor One World in the funny 115, but there was a lot there, I have to say.
Minimal. It's One World is one I have a problem with because there's not a lot of fun moments in it. Almost all my One World stuff involves Cat or Tarzan. Or Colton in some variant.
Well, oh boy.
If it's one of those threes, because there's nothing else really going on. It's like Kim is great, but she's not especially funny.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we talked about that this past week. And then, we've got an all-timer coming up on Talking with T-Bird that we're going to drop on Sunday night. Very, very excited. Check that out. Robiswebsite.com.
So you're not going to tell us who. We're going to have to wait.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't even know who this is.
Yes. It's a really good one coming up.
Yeah. All right. Well, I can't wait to check that out. And of course, where are we finding everybody on social media these days?
You can find me on Twitter at Mario J. Lanza. Although I'll admit I'm not the greatest Twitter user. I don't use it that much, but I do publicize when I have projects coming out. So that's me. Or Facebook. I do Facebook more. You can friend me if you like reality TV or comedy writing or anything. I just love talking about pop culture stuff.
Yep. And of course, you're going to be publishing more detailed notes about The Stand as you watch the last two episodes, I would guess.
Absolutely. Although I will consider this podcast to be my notes for episode 7. So I'm going to take a mulligan on this one, but I will start writing on episode 8 again.
Yeah.
All right. Can't wait. And of course, Rob, we can find you on the Twitter at Rob Sesternino.
That's right.
And you can find me on the Twitter at Haymaker Hattie. We really want to know your thoughts about everything that happened in episode 7 and what you think the ending is going to be like. And Twitter is one great way to do it. You can also hit us up on our patron Discord. If you are a patron of Post Show Recaps, and you really should be at this point, hop into our Discord, and there is a channel just for The Stand where we have a lot of fun breaking everything down. And this has really been.
I'm going to go on there.
Please, Rob, please stop by. The Discord is an amazing place, and it's really the greatest thing I think that's come out of our Patreon program. And of course, if you want to support us at that level, these podcasts are always free, but if you want to get extra content and the opportunity to hang out with us in the Discord, you can hit up patreon.com/postshowrecaps or postshowrecaps.com/patreon. I promise you will not regret this decision. There's so much there for you. There's at least 3 extra podcasts a week. There is the aforementioned Discord. At the merch tier, you can get a piece of Post Show Recaps merchandise in your mailbox every 3 months. And that includes a Wiggler's Wombats hat if you want one. So everything is very fun for the patrons of Post Show Recaps. And of course, we have a lot of great things coming up on the Post Show Recaps docket this week. We are covering Star Wars. We are covering Avatar The Last Airbender. We are doing a rewatch of The X-Files. We are doing new shows and old shows and at least one show a day. So please come by our general feed and check that out. So I want to thank you once again, Mario, for stopping by. This was really a lot of fun.
Yeah.
Yeah. Absolutely. Invite me back anytime. I love talking with you guys. It's fun talking with smart, nerdy people that like talking about pop culture. That's pretty much what I do.
Yeah. And it's also been extra fun to talk to a smart, nerdy person whose takes on this series are wildly opposite from my own.
I still don't get that, but whatever. See, you're a smart person. And I respect your opinion. So I try to understand why you don't like it. I just don't agree with it.
Isn't it amazing that we can debate something and disagree on it and it's not the end of the world? I feel like the world is letting us do that again.
You literally are debating about the end of the world.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm kind of pissed. I'm going to go storm the Capitol now. see you guys later.
Storm Paramount. Yeah.
Make sure you live stream that.
Yeah. No, that's, I mean, that's, you make a good point. We're joking around, but like, there's something to be said for, and people in the world can just talk and disagree with stuff and still respect each other. And I've known Jessica forever. I probably disagree on pretty much anything, but I think she's great. I love talking with her. I just like hanging around smart people that have good opinions. That's the kind of what life is about.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I also like hanging out with Rob.
Yeah. It's nice that we invited Rob here too.
I picked that point. What you did there. Good callback to Stu and Glenn. Yeah. Yeah.
Laws, yes.
Yes. No, but this was great. And Mario, your hot takes are always appreciated.
Thank you, Rob. Thank you, Robert.
Yes. And of course, thank you, Rob, for joining me on this stand quest. I would not have stuck with the whole series had it not been for you. And I'm really glad I did at this point.
Come on. We got to see how it turns out.
Really?
I'm thanking the wrong person. Thanks, Rob, then.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Screw you, Jessica.
Fair enough. Fair enough. I've been really glad that we're sticking through it and seeing it through to the end. So we got two more weeks of this, and Rob and I will be here breaking it down for all of you listeners, who I also need to thank. We appreciate you being here. And of course, we will talk to you next week. Thanks, everyone. We out.
With the Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.